Hello and welcome to another edition of The Measuring Post. My name is Joe Massa, and this is a very unique episode because we are actually recording on two separate days. This is by far the furthest away I've ever had a guest on The Measuring Post. I'm going to tell you where she is in just a moment, but first I would love to introduce to you my esteemed guest today. She's an award-winning author, an educator, a holistic well-being advocate. She combines not only cutting-edge science, but also spiritual philosophy that helps inspire a sort of holistic wellness and a fullness of living. So with that in mind, please welcome all the way from New Zealand, my new Kiwi friend, Kim Forrester. How are you? And welcome to The Measuring Post.
Joe, thank you so much. You do such good work and it's wonderful to be here. And, you know, anyone who's watching the video might have noticed that in the background, there was a little clue. My cushions there that say New Zealand in the background. So,
but you're not just tied down in New Zealand. You're international, global. You've been all over the place. So we'll get into that in a little bit. But you're actually a day ahead of me. So she assured me that tomorrow does actually happen. So we have someone on the inside that can warn us of the impending doom that's awaiting us.
I assure you it's fabulous.
Lovely, lovely. Well, it's very nice to get you on the show. I know we've already had a pre-interview and got to meet, and I really love everything that you're all about, not only with your work and as an author, but just your whole outlook on life. And I really want to dive deep in this, but I want to forewarn everybody, I'm going to probably butcher some words on this episode, and it's because they are very Aborigine and very local to that community down in New Zealand and other places that you've been, also in Asia and Europe. And of course, I apologize in advance for sounding like a typical American that doesn't know, because I've never been there.
No, I totally appreciate that. And we just appreciate you paying attention and being interested. Thank you.
Yeah, it was nice when you reached out. I definitely feel like there's a lot we could learn from you. And let's just start with the basics. You're not only a great author and educator and holistic person that's trying to help people live, but you're a mother, you're a nature lover, you're a global traveler, you're a kindness enthusiast, things that get often overlooked but are really so important. And of course, are you still living down in Hamilton? Is that the city you're in?
No, I left Hamilton many, many years ago, spent more than 20 years outside of New Zealand and recently returned. So I'm now living in the deep south, which for us means it's the cold part of New Zealand. But if anyone has seen Lord of the Rings, I am in that part of the country with the spectacular scenery in the mountains. So my backyard's not bad.
And you actually educated me a little bit. I was under the impression that New Zealand and Australia were like very similar, but based on our conversation, that's not the case.
No, that's correct. So Australia as a continent has been around for millions of years. New Zealand rose recently out of the sea. And I say recently, but, you know, a million years or so. We are actually more like Hawaii. So if you want to, you know, consider New Zealand's geography and geology, it is actually more like a cold version of Hawaii than it is Australia.
I've been to Hawaii. I do know that. And I love it out there. And that's what a lot of the words that I'm about to butcher actually come from, right? That sort of dialect. Do you actually use the Hawaiian alphabet? Because I know they have quite a few less letters.
So when the English colonizers came to New Aotearoa, it was called then, and met the Maori people, they kindly gave them a set of letters, but they didn't give them the full alphabet. So the Maori language, so it's Maori is how it's pronounced. And so the R is like a D sound. They are our indigenous people. They have been here for between 1200 to 800 years, but they did come from a magical, mystical land called Hawaiki. So see if you can work that one out. They came in their canoe. And so, like I say, it is very similar to Hawaii because we have that beautiful Polynesian flavor and the geology and geography is very much the same.
So one of the words I actually did a listen to before to try to get it is Porongia. Porongia. Tell me about Porongia. Am I saying that one right?
Absolutely. So like many indigenous people, the Maori people of New Zealand are deeply, deeply connected with their land, with the land. They understand that we are actually formed of the land, right? When we're growing in our mother's womb, it's actually the nutrients from the land and the soil that goes through the food and creates our bodies. So when you introduce yourself, traditionally here in New Zealand, you introduce yourself according to your water. So that'll be your river or your ocean and your mountain. So Pirongia is my mountain, as is Mango Tautere. So Hamilton City has got two beautiful, it's an alluvial plain, so it's quite flat, but there are two beautiful mountains that stand there, Mango Tautere and Pirongia. So Pirongia is my mountain and Waikato is my awa, is my river. So the Waikato River flows through. And that's a way of explaining not just who I am, but where I belong, where I come from.
I love that. So really being in touch with your environment and the earth and just nature as a whole. And you talk about not just nourishing the body and brain, but also like just the human essence in general and the subtle unseen forces that shape us. And obviously the word is unseen. So how do you get in touch with this sort of realm or essence that you talk about?
Well, it's all around us. I just think that the issue is, we have come to regard ourselves, A, as machines. So, and I'm talking about in the Western world because Indigenous people and land-based cultures still today are very deeply entwined with their natural way of being. So I just want to start this whole conversation by saying we are nature, Joe. We forget that. We are nature. We don't go out into nature. We are nature. And so, when we realign ourselves with our natural selves and our natural instincts and our natural needs and desires and the natural things that we need to flourish, that's what brings us into a deeper and a more fuller way of living. And a lot of what, you know, there's a lot of words out there for what that essence of being human is. Some people call it soul. Some people call it prana. Here in New Zealand, the Māori call it Māori. It's basically a life force. It's chi and throughout places in Asia. And that is the pilot light that makes us us. And it doesn't reside in the brain. Confucian and Taoist, the Chinese worldviews, they talk about the heart mind, and it's about living from the heart mind. So it's not just thinking things, but actually feeling, being deeply intuitive, being self-reflective, evolving, because that's a huge part of nature, right? Nature is designed to evolve, and so are we. And just becoming more cognizant of our natural needs and our natural rhythms.
Yeah, I love that. And you're right. There's so many different words for it across multiple different cultures. And obviously, there's got to be something there. If it's felt and believed in and a practice that is so widespread, there has to absolutely be something there. And I think, you know, one of the things you talk about is that most humans are only really perceiving like less than 5% of actual reality. And the well-being and sort of your connection to these larger forces is beyond our actual daily comprehension.
So science used to be a practice of observing the universe and then understanding patterns in the universe and writing it down. That's how science began, right? And including Indigenous science practices. You would observe what happens in the world and the universe around you, and then you would write that down and find patterns. And then from those patterns, you could start predicting the future. We have lost that. In the last 300-400 years, science became almost like a religion in itself and a dogma. And it was like, well, now we know exactly what it is, what the universe is. And so we're going to stop observing things like people who have intuitive hunches or premonitions. We're going to stop that. And we're going to divorce people from the sense of a soul or a life force that flows through us. We're going to disconnect ourselves from ourselves, nature, and each other. What we need to understand is that our science currently understands how ignorant we are. So we've finally got to a point where cosmologists have weighed the universe and they've gone, oh, do you know what? There's actually a lot of stuff out there. In fact, 95% of the universe, not the size of the universe, the composition of the universe, 95% of the composition of the universe is totally unknown to us. We don't even know where to begin to measure it. They call it dark matter and dark energy, which is a very simplified way of saying, oh, that scares us and we don't really want to talk about it. But Joe, that 95% is impacting us. It is in us, of us, from us, to us, around us. It is interacting with us. It is forming us. We are being formed through it. So we can't ignore that it is there anymore. And the fact is, if we come back to the true premise of science, which is, well, let's observe. Let's observe our life. Let's observe that sense of intuition, or that sense of connectedness, or a sense of wonder and awe that we get in some places and not other places. That there has been continued to be described to us in spiritual ways. But a lot of people forget about it because it doesn't yet fit into that little 5% of what science actually can understand.
Yeah, I think you nailed it on the head there. And it's true. We do know enough now to know that we don't know much at all. And,
correct.
You know, even like the human brain, we understand that there's only a small portion of our brain that we actually access on a regular basis. So clearly there's a big chunk of what's going on up here alone that we have no idea and don't understand what it's doing. And I think that's something to take into consideration when you're picturing the vastness of the universe and the galaxies and even the planet, you know, the vastness of our Earth. There is so much that is undiscovered and unknown that doesn't make sense to our traditional way of thinking, that we have to consider that there's something bigger than what we are. So that kind of leads me to a question about this sort of spirituality that you follow and that you're talking about. How does that differ from like a traditional religion like Christianity or Buddhism? Is there interconnectivity? Is there crossover? Or is it sort of a separate branch of spirituality?
Well, because I've had the great blessing of being able to live all over the world. I lived in Europe, you know, obviously grew up here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, lived through Asia. So one of the things that I picked up as I was traveling around the world was how similar the core messages are of everyone's worldview and everyone's spirituality and everyone's religion. They all seem to be pointing to the same destination. They might start in different places or have different stories around that, but they all seem to point to some very fundamental spiritual concepts. So my mind is not big enough to understand the universe. So I'm not going to say to anyone human, hey, you know, your spirituality is flawed or your religion is wrong, because I don't know that. And what I guess I'd love for people to understand is that none of us know it. The universe is, and its vastness and its complexity, if you want to align that with like the mind of a god or gods, it is too vast for our tiny wee human brains to comprehend. So let's stop trying to actually understand it. Appreciate that there are stories, and they are various stories all around the world, but let's get under the rhetoric and the words, and let's get to the core message. And it's all the same. And that message is, A, we are of the universe, right? So we arise from the universe. We are not separate from it. We are not separate from one another. We're deeply connected to one another. And what we do to others, we do to ourselves. Now, that's actually a quantum theory. It's called entanglement. And so what we do to others, we literally do to ourselves, because we mess with the quantum field. Kindness and goodness is key to well-being, is key to a good life. And there is a way to create a utopia for yourself. Now, some faiths sort of believe that comes at the end of life. Others say, no, you actually create it through your life. And there's a fundamental principle that we are heading towards an understanding of how to create a heaven or a utopia on earth. And what I see that as, when you go through all of the different worldviews and faiths, is actually about living your life in such a way that there is goodness in your life, in this moment, and no matter what is going on around you, you are resonating with a sense of peace and well-being and goodwill.
I kind of attribute that to like the ripple effect too. You talk about how kindness is so great, and really when you're living in that world of kindness and goodness and whole, you know, being one with everything around you, the entanglement, there is a ripple effect. You're spreading that frequency out into your world. And I think that's something that always really intrigued me. Now, I grew up in a Catholic house, so it was very Christian based, but I always was intrigued by this notion of energy and frequencies, and you can pick up on people's vibes. And that's why, you know, you get that gut feeling sometimes, intuition, like, that's not a person I want to be around. Or you gravitate towards somebody because they're putting out this energy and frequency that can be felt, can't be seen, can't mm-hmm. be heard, but you just know. And you know what's really interesting? You'll see animals pick up on this a lot. Like, absolutely. There's certain people that animals just flock to because they're like, this is a good person. So I need to be in that little sphere or ecosystem around them. So I think that's really interesting that people and, you know, animals, different things, creatures can pick up on these vibes.
Absolutely.
So there's obviously something there.
Well, we are animals, Joe. And so, I mean, true. So much to share this. So just briefly, yes, I mean, science has shown that kindness is actually contagious. So if you, even if you witness an act of kindness, it gives you such a boost of well-being in your brain and body that you are then more likely to go and be kind. Hope is contagious. Happiness is contagious. If you focus on being happy in your life, not in a selfish way, but just being full of joy and goodwill, then your friends are 9% happier. And your friends' friends and your friends' friends' friends. So happiness flows through our social circles as well. So yes, all of these really, we are social creatures and we're deeply interconnected. And so when we make a change, a really positive change, it has an impact on the people around us. But you're talking about the energy as well. You're right. I mean, a lot of that can be explained, you know, kindness and optimism when you're in someone's vicinity can be explained as, you know, just a psychological and physiological experience. But studies have also shown that inspiration is contagious. So if you are someone creating something and you are inspired when you create that, that might be a work of art or a piece of music or, you know, a piece of text, a prose. If you are inspired when you create it, someone who then consumes that work of art later is more likely to feel inspired. So it's got nothing to do with the human-to-human contact. That inspiration, the energy of that inspiration is literally imbued into the work of art and people pick it up. Isn't that incredible?
I absolutely believe that, though. I mean, when you do see something that's very beautiful, like a piece of art, or hear a piece of music that catches your ear, and I'm certainly no musician, but it's really interesting how quickly I get into a musical vibe, and I just want to be a part of that moment, even though clearly the person that created it could be hundreds of miles, thousands of miles away from me. So yeah, that is interesting that you have that energy sort of connected to that piece of work as well, because that's something that I never really considered. And that kind of leads me to another creative piece of work. You yourself are a creative person. You've written two books yourself. You've actually written one called The Infinite Mind, which was awarded, by the way, a silver medal at the 2016 Living Now Book Awards. And your second book, Thrive, which is 52 traits and behaviors that help people flourish in modern life. So tell us a little bit about where your inspiration came from and just a brief overview of those two books.
So I have learned to live deeply intuitively, Joe. I have a resonance in my life, I guess that modi, that life force. I know what that feels like when I'm really attuned to it. And so I seek that out in my life. I am curious about the opportunities and the thoughts that pop up in my world, and I follow the ones that are most resonant. So, and I guess I am inspired, right? So what inspires me? My own sense of resonance is what guides me. And so Infinite Mind, I live a wonderful life. I am so incredibly blessed. I feel really empowered. I enjoy being of service to others. I have healed a lot of my own, you know, trauma and emotional blocks. And I've done that because I've learned to really, really trust my inner guidance, my inner GPS. And one of my most meaningful campaigns, if you will, is to get people to understand that we are animals and we have an animal instinct, that we are deeply entwined with the universe, including the quantum universe, which transcends time and space. So therefore, we have a mind, we have a body that can actually absorb information from beyond time space. And throughout history and in laboratories, so in experiments, it has shown that this incredible instinct that we have is inevitably something that helps us. So Socrates, back in his day, he was a bit of a madman, right, in ancient Greece, and he would go out here and he didn't suffer fools lightly, and he was saying some things that were pretty radical for the time, and he ended up being put on trial for it, and eventually he was put to death. But he always said that his wisdom came from his inner voice. He called it his demon, and he literally had voices in his head. Now, not in terms of his psychological, disorder. He had a wise guru that spoke to him, and he actually talked about it in his trial. And he said, "Hey, all the good stuff I've been sharing wasn't from me. It was from this incredible voice that I get in my head." And he said, "It always compels me to do what is right, and it stops me from doing things that are harmful to myself or others." So that's just one example of how this beautiful intuitive force that we have, if we can step out of that 5% of the scientific paradigm, although science now has already shown to in the laboratories that this exists. We live good lives, Joe. We live good lives. And it doesn't matter what your spirituality or your faith or your worldview is. It transcends that. And however you interpret that in your life or translate that, whether it's the voice of God that comes through to you through prayer, or whether it's an animal totem that appears to you, or whether it's your ancestors speaking to you, which tends to be here through Polynesia, that it's the ancestors. It doesn't matter how you bring that into your life. I just really want people to understand and use it. Anyway, long way of saying, that's what Infinite Mind is about. True stories of people who have followed this instinct in incredible ways, and then a little taste of the science so that people can go, oh, it fits into the 21st century understanding of the universe.
I love that you're mentioning Socrates and that analogy of him hearing the voices, which obviously he declared at his trial, and he lived that way. There is a couple other people in history that were great, brilliant minds that have also mentioned this. One was Werner von Braun, who was the father of rocketry, the German scientist that essentially we brought here to the United States to take over the NASA, you know, lead so we could get to space first. And he always swore that there was these things in his head that he would hear that gave him this wisdom and information that clearly he would not have known from his traditional schooling or his environment or his parents. And of course, you know, get the ancient aliens conspiracy theorists who say that's what it is. Then it's the voice of God. Maybe it's the universe just giving information to somebody. Maybe the information's there, but he was receptive to it. And he had the ability to decipher what was being put out there in the universe. But again, he was one of these brilliant minds that did so much in such a short human life, and he lived a long life, but life in general is so short in the big picture. How would he have gained that much knowledge if there wasn't something that he was tapping into that was much bigger than us? So I like that you had that analogy. I literally watched that not too long ago on an Ancient Aliens episode. It was late night TV, great, just scrolling. But it was interesting to see, you know, them talk about how he would make these statements that, this isn't from my mind. I'm just the vessel that's putting it out there. And this is coming in from somewhere. So there's something to that.
The amount of physicists and theoretical physicists and brilliant minds, genius minds, that also truly believe that we have not, well, they understand. It's not that they believe. They know the limitations of our knowledge because they are, you know, they're light years ahead of us in terms of understanding. And so many physicists and theoretical physicists are going, hey, it's actually real. I mean, the US government has been actually using this, using intuition in the sixth sense, formally in military sense, since the 1960s and 70s. And you can go and you can find the, you know, the files on that. So, but there's a story about that in my book as well. Yes, it's all out there. And the people who know, like the people who really know about the universe, they're going, yeah, no, that's real.
Yeah, and it doesn't surprise me that a military or government would be using this to their benefit on any level.
Right.
Certainly, you know, that's sort of the name of the game. The people at the top like to pull the strings, but or gatekeep this vast information that we know. But I have a question. Did a lot of this start in your younger years? I know in your university, you got a diploma of positive psychology and well-being. So that's a degree I've never really heard of. So obviously this way of life started very young. It was instilled to you. But as you got to the college age level, what pushed you to get a degree in positive psychology?
Well, what's interesting is though, I actually wasn't into sort of this stuff in, as a child. And I really want people to understand that, because I think that there is a there's a story that gets told out there, because I think it's the story that's expected, that if you are a highly intuitive person or a deeply spiritual person, it's something that you've had since childhood. No. No, I was 26 when I went along to my first spiritual development circle, and the messages that I got were just ridiculously bad. And I wasn't necessarily interested in the blending of science and spirituality at all until my 30s. But once again, but I just followed that. It wasn't time. And when it was time, I felt the resonance and I followed it. And I never went to college or university after high school. I went traveling and learnt languages instead. So when my son started university, I went and got a couple of diplomas. So the first one was in philosophy, because I wanted to understand the way that people see the world in various various locations and cultures. And then the second diploma I got was positive psychology and well-being. Positive psychology is a beautiful and very recent addition to clinical psychology, to standard psychology. Psychology itself, since World War II, and you had all these soldiers coming back with deep trauma, psychology became about getting you from minus 10 to zero, right? So I'm going to take someone who is lacking in psychological stability, and I'll get them to a point where they're okay. And then in the year 2000, this new part of psychology was introduced, positive psychology. And this is the bit I love, because it's about saying, okay, well, what if you're not unwell, but you're not thriving? How do we get from meh? How do we get from languishing to life's freaking awesome and I am driven and I'm feeling great? You know, that energy that you sort of exude, Joe, right? That's positive psychology. And this is incredible, because it ties in so much with the spiritual philosophies that people have been taught through the years and around the world. Kindness. Positive psychology has researched the importance of kindness. It has researched the importance of forgiveness and what it does for us and our well-being. The importance of acceptance, right, and surrender. That's a very Buddhist concept, is to actually rise above. Actually, Jesus said to it too, turn the other cheek. So if rise above drama, rise above conflict. So now there's a growing interest in this field, positive psychology, and there are a growing number of people who are saying, hey, let's look at the traits that help us thrive. That was my second book. So it's about the daily practices that we can engage in that not only have a really positive effect on our environment, our society, but our well-being as well.
So that's a perfect segue, because that was literally one of my next questions. I'll put one thing in front of it, and then I'd like you to share some simple but powerful practices that people can do in their everyday lives to sort of get on this journey. But also, you talk about the fullness of living, and what exactly does that mean to you?
So the fullness of living is literally about getting outside of that box, that 5% box. And I think that it's about understanding that most of us and most of our life is a mystery. And being okay and being curious, being okay with and being curious about that mystery. Fullness of living is waking up on a day where things aren't going great and having the courage and the resilience and the strength to say, things aren't going great and I will deal with this. I'm okay with this because I know that this is how life is and things will get better again. Fullness of living is about understanding the power of being of service to others and understanding how much we thrive individually when we actually make our life about giving to others. Fullness of living is about being your natural self and understanding that you have natural needs, just like every domestic animal out there or farmed animal, and we understand that they have needs to thrive as an animal. We have needs to thrive as an animal as well. The reason that I term it fullness of living is because I observe that most people regard wellness in a really superficial way. And let me give you an example. I was an expatriate, like an immigrant around Southeast Asia for 20 years, and I would move to a new city in a new country, and I would go along, and inevitably there would be a support network for Australians and New Zealanders. We tend to gather together, right? And you get this checklist, or they'd have wonderful workshops where you'd go along and they would say, okay, we're going to help you settle into Singapore, for instance. And they would say, right, here's the schools that you can send your kids to, and here's how to get a bank account, and here's how to find a house in a great location that you'll enjoy, and here's a coffee morning so that you can meet people. And I looked at that and went, yeah, but those are tick boxes. How am I going to be okay? How am I dealing with the loss of friendships that I've left behind? How am I dealing with the distance of being away from a family, particularly if my family member is unwell or is going through something? I want to be there. How do I deal with a lack of identity? I've had to give up my career or whatever to move here. So the general understanding of wellness and well-being was so superficial. If we want to live a full life, we have to also go deeper and say, now, what fills me up? What's the emotional, the spiritual, the meaningful, the deeper essence of thriving that I also need to look at?
That's a very thorough answer, and I think it's very accurate. No. I didn't mean that in a way that it was long-winded or unappreciated. It was great. But I think that's a great worldview and just internal reflection view of not just going surface level and saying, Well, I'm okay now because I got my morning coffee. I have somebody I can talk to. I'm safe. Okay.
I do yoga 3 times a week, whatever. Yeah, exactly.
And those are great things. You want those things. But to truly live life and to truly experience a moment, you do have to take the good with the bad, the front with the back, the left with the right, the full encompassing version of what's going on around you. So I like that. I think it's a really unique way to, perceive things. So that takes me back to the previous question. What's one thing that the average person, the average Joe, can do in their daily life to experience that sort of fullness of living?
Right. A couple of things. First of all, understand that studies have shown 40% of your happiness comes from the daily choices that you make, right? So you are actually more in control of your own happiness level than you understand. And that comes down to choosing more positivity and getting rid of negativity. And that includes your own negativity. So watch your own behaviors. Watch the choices and habits. Understand that it's just psychological habits, neurological habits, and there's nothing wrong with you. We just choose habits that are bad for us. So choose more kindness. Choose to be deeply connected with other people. Understand that as humans, the reason that Homo sapiens thrived outside of Africa, where the hominids died out, is because we chose to cooperate and come together as communities. It is the only thing we did differently from Neanderthals and other hominids, is that we came together and we shared knowledge and we shared space and we took care of one another. It's important.
So you hear that, pessimist? No, you got to be nice to each other. Be kind.
And that's not, you don't disregard negativity in your life. But there is a study that shows that if we can have three positive experiences for every negative experience, we tend to thrive. And we need to seek that out, Joe, because our brain is wired to seek out negativity. So we need to seek out. So here, one thing today, I want your listeners and viewers to count kindness in the coming week. Count it. I want you to pay attention to the world around you. And instead of like the headlines and yada, 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 count kindness, because you will see it everywhere. The kindness you do, the kindness that you see other people performing, you will see that our world is incredibly kind, and people outside of the headlines underneath, people are just getting on with living a really good life and trying to be the best people they can. The other thing I really encourage people to do is seek out psychological richness in terms of a good life. There are three ways to value a good life. One is a happy life, where I just want to feel as pleasant as possible all the time. The problem with trying to feel pleasant all the time is that we can stay safe. We don't push into our discomfort zone, because discomfort zones are really messy sometimes. So being happy is great, but being psychologically rich is actually a far more wondrous way to live life. And that means, you know what, I'm going to get curious. I'm going to get curious about the world. I'm going to get curious about what I don't yet know, the mysteries of myself and the universe. I'm going to get curious about what my capabilities are. So that would be the other thing. So first of all, understand cooperation, kindness, and connection are the fundamental things that make us human. And secondly, a good life, a thriving life, is actually one where you are pushing your own boundaries in a really curious and self-compassionate way.
I love that. And you said something that was unique and stuck out to me, because humans are by nature drawn to the negative. Mm-hmm. And we do look at that. But I like when you said count the kindnesses, because by putting it that way, you're forcing yourself to pay attention to kindness. And you're sort of changing the filter on your view. Instead of going, life is bad, this is tough, work sucks, I'm not happy, I don't feel good. Instead of always having that negative cloud over you, sort of the woe is me, chicken little, sky's always falling down mentality, you're saying, man, look what that person just did for that other person. That was really kind. Look what that little kid picked that, you know, gave that dog a piece of his food. That was really kind. He did something kind. But by noticing those things, you're creating a habit within yourself to look for those pieces of goodness in the world. And I think that internally can lift a lot of people out of darkness. It's really easy to get sucked into a negative mindset. And it's really hard to get out of it, but maybe just observing goodness is enough to really sort of snowball that into a bigger effect in your life.
I want people to understand that don't beat yourself up if you're feeling bad about the world or whatever. Our society is currently set up to bombard us with negative information, and our brains are literally wired to seek it out. So it's not your fault if you're feeling like everything's just a bit yucky at the moment, right? It's literally society feeding this part of you that wants to be fed. It's just about gently understanding that and going, oh, so my brain is only noticing the negative because that's what it wants to, that's what it needs to do for my survival, basically, you know, out on the plains when there's a tiger chasing you. But you can gently choose a different way, and it starts with those daily practices.
And there's another great sort of story or tale that comes from the Native American community in North America. And it's very similar to that. And the reason I bring this up, and I don't know exactly who said it, so I apologize in advance, but this came to me when you were saying that. And we're talking about how this world is sort of interconnected, and there's this intangible connection between communities and countries and people, and we're all really on this same level. But there's a story that was passed down through the Native American communities where there's two wolves inside of you, and one is good and positive and productive, and the other is negative and malicious and evil. And this grandfather is telling his grandson the story, and the grandson says, well, if there's a war going on, which one of the two wolves wins? And the simple answer is whichever one you feed. Exactly. So if you feed the good wolf and the positive, that's what's going to come out victorious. And alternatively, if you live in a negative mindset and you thrive in that environment, that's where you're going to end up staying.
Which is precisely what I was talking about this spiritual concept of heaven on earth. Because if you are choosing the positivity, and not to say that you dismiss negativity, it's a part of life. But if you are waking like I do most mornings and going, okay, cool, whatever comes my way, I know I've got this. I'm so grateful for this. I love the kindness and the compassion and connection I see around me in my own life. I'm living a heaven on earth. People who are stuck in the negativity, they don't experience the world the same way that I do.
And a lot of those people that live in the negativity, I would imagine, they're also the people that never find satisfaction or fulfillment. They could have all the money they could ever want in the world, but that's still not enough. They could have the most beautiful spouse, and that's not enough. They could have the biggest house on the planet, and that's not enough, because they're trying to fill a void inside of them, a presence with material. And obviously it's nice to have nice things. We all work and we like to take trips and have nice cars. That's all great and fine and dandy, but it's never going to feed your soul. It's never going to feed your spirit.
Correct. You're not living in a full way. And that's precisely right. It's about, research has shown that once you're at a level where you can sort of have a home and your health, I think it's about $70,000, you don't actually get much happier after that, right? So once you are comfortable in life, money does not bring you any happiness. In fact, 20% of the ultra, ultra rich are miserable. 20% of the billionaires out there are living a terrible, awful, soulless life. So no, money is not the answer at all. And years ago, I read a very wise quote, and I can't remember who said it, but it was that we accumulate in this day and age because we're trying to feel bigger. We're trying to feel like we matter. We're trying to build our space in the universe, where in actual fact, when you go inside and you feed yourself and when you connect with others, you are already bigger. If you connect with your community and you're really coming down and coming in with that resonance, you're connecting with the whole universe, because we are made up. We are deeply connected with the universe. But it is, so you're right, Joe. It sounds cliche, but it's actually right. The fullness that you're looking for, that sense of accomplishment, the sense of wellness, the sense of acceptance and belonging, it's not out there. It really is just coming back and going, okay, what am I going to choose today that'll help me connect? What am I going to choose today that will help me make the world a more positive place? What am I going to choose today to help me see the goodness in life? And start there.
And I think a lot of that comes down to the management of your time, right? We all have to work. We all sleep. We all eat. There's certain things that are unavoidable in life. But you talk about, some of the ultra rich and how miserable they are. It's because they're doing things that don't serve them internally. You're right. Doesn't matter if they're taking care of a corporation or this or that. Your time is your only true, real valuable asset. Money is a man-made construct to keep us in some sort of level hierarchy society, but your time is the only thing that you can't get back, truly, as far as your time on earth as a human, the way I believe it. And then there's the afterlife that we'll go to for eternity, whether you go to live in a cloud in heaven with God, or you go back to the universe and just go into the ether and the energy. That's irrelevant, because we you're right. None of us truly know that until you get there. But using your time wisely is something that people drastically underappreciate. And you could use your time for a nice conversation like this and get value and learn and just enjoy some human interaction. Or you can go give to your community and feel that kindness and goodness. Or you can choose to be the hardest working person that puts in 90 hours a week. And then someday on your tombstone, it said, "Here lies Joe Massa. He worked really hard." And Did I enjoy myself? Did I get fulfillment out of life? Probably not if I live that way. So I'm a firm believer in using your time for what suits you and serves you, not only individually, but your inner circle, your family, your community, and your friends.
Absolutely, because time is attention. Wherever you're spending your time, you're spending your attention. And meaning and purpose, like living with a sense of purpose and meaning, and it doesn't have to be a grand sense of purpose. You know, your purpose might be just to spread a smile throughout your community every day, right? But if that is feeling meaningful to you, it not only enhances your sense of well-being and happiness, it helps you live longer. So soon after, in early January 2000, there was this huge spike in deaths amongst the elderly all around the world. And researchers were trying to figure out what was going on. Why was there this huge spike in deaths soon after we clocked into the new millennium? And they realized that what had happened is that there had been fewer deaths in the months leading up to it. So a lot of these elderly folk had wanted to stick around to see the new millennium. They wanted to live in the year 2000. And that will alone, that sense of purpose, no, I'm going to stick around and I'm going to see the new year, I'm going to see the year 2000, was enough to keep them alive. And that's just one. There are actually so many studies now that show that having a sense of purpose in your day, it almost feeds that soul. It feeds that pilot light of essence, that human essence that we are.
Yeah. And I have one point to make to that, but you know, what's really cool. You hear about the stories of the people that were born in like 1899, 1898, and they lived to 2000. They got to live in three centuries. That would be pretty cool. Bonkers. So, but you know, there's a truth to that, because you also hear about these stories when somebody's lying on their deathbed, even maybe comatose, and you have that the son or the daughter that comes in and goes, "Mom, Dad, it's okay. You can let go now." And then they do, you know, but it's that sense of like, even now here on my deathbed in a coma, I know deep down in my subconscious somewhere, my son and my daughter, they're going to need me, that I can't go yet. It's not my time. But once you get that confirmation that your purpose, for lack of a better term, has been fulfilled, you've raised two beautiful children, it's okay to go. They're acknowledging, they're sad, but they're saying, "It's okay, Dad, you can leave now." And then you hear about those stories all the time. And clearly, I think that there is a lot of truth to that, because you have to have something to drive you every day. And hopefully it's something good.
Well, it needs to be something good if you truly want it to feed you. Like if you want to be driven by something that's actually going to fill you up, it will inevitably be something to do with creativity, connection, compassion.
I love it. So on the hot seat real quick, let's get a little personal. One question for you: when you're not inspiring others on podcasts, doing global international talks, writing books, what feeds your soul, Kim? What enjoyment and fulfillment do you get from life?
I am deeply inspired by the billions of people every day who are giving in small ways that we will never know about. What I love, one of the many things that I love about my homeland, about New Zealand, is that there is a lot of positivity on the media. So every night on the nightly news, and soon afterwards, everyday New Zealanders are celebrated in small ways, and they will visit, you know, the lady who has been running a community centre in a small town of New Zealand and has not had a holiday for 30 years because she gives all of her holiday time to volunteer for, the underprivileged children in the area. And I am humbled by the people who get up and go to the elderly care homes and take care of other people's grandparents and great-grandparents. I am humbled by the incredible people that set up bedding banks for the underprivileged or the homeless. And I am humbled by the people who go around, and there's a wonderful organization here where groups of women get together and they cook dinners for new mums, you know, mums who have got a new baby and perhaps they've got other children as well, and it's just all too much. And so they are supported by these community organisations that will deliver them a week's worth of food so that they don't have to worry about dinner. That inspires me, Joe, and it inspires me to be a better person, because I go, sure, I do books and podcasts or whatever, but I'm not doing that. That's where it counts.
Making actual differences in the lives of the people around you. So I Absolutely. Think that's what I picked up from that. And I think that there's so much there. And honestly, that's really why I wanted to start this podcast. It was, you know, the tag under, it's a place to learn and grow together. But really, the only way we do that is from talking to people that are out there actually doing and growing in the world. And whether that's in New Zealand or here in Denver, where I live, there's communities all over the place that need people. They need positivity. They need the doers, the thinkers, the innovators. And you can be one of those people by simply tapping into it and acknowledging it and tuning into the environment around you. And I think that this is very eye-opening to me, because I love to learn from other cultures as well. And, you know, New Zealand, and talking to you, it doesn't seem like we're on the other side of the planet. You're in the future. You're in a whole day ahead of me. And it's just, I think it's really eye-opening that you talk about how similar all these cultures across the planet are. And it really shows in conversations like this. So
yeah,
I love getting to talk to people like you and learn from your experiences, because I probably will never go spend 20 years living in Asia. My wife is even Asian. She's Cambodian. And you know, visits are about all we get, but it's never going to be where we move there. So to have somebody that goes and lives that experience is something is very unique, and you can share that knowledge. And I just truly appreciate that you shared it with us here today.
It's a pleasure, Joe.
So Kim, where can we find you online? Now, I personally know, but I'm letting you plug here. Where can we find your book, Infinite Mind and Thrive? And what's a great way for people to reach out to you and connect and find just more about what you do?
Excellent. Best port of call is kimforrester.net. So kimforrester.net. And there are links there to my socials. Come along. I just, four times a week, I just put up posts that are generally there to help remind you about goodness in life and how to thrive. And you can find Infinite Mind and my book Thrive via my website as well. Come say hi.
Absolutely. And I'll make sure to put those links in and around this video when we publish it. And again, Kim, it's been fantastic talking with you. Is there any final words of wisdom you'd like to share before we part ways today?
Just a reminder that the only reason that humans survived outside of Africa is because we learned to cooperate and share and take care of each other. It is our evolutionary calling to do so.
You heard it here. Take care of those around you, and obviously take care of yourself. Well, once again, Kim Forrester, thank you for your time. I appreciate you coming on to The Measuring Post.
It's a pleasure, Joe. Thank you.